From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the program, a Milwaukee researcher tries to rein in the emotions surrounding concussions in sports.
Really, the story has raced out in front of the science, and that is unfortunate in any health science area, including concussion.
Later, NPR's Peter Sagal talks about his upcoming trip to Milwaukee and the news that his Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me sidekick, Carl Castle, is retiring. And then Carl Castle himself looks back on the conversation that landed him on the comedy show in the first place.
I said, you do newscasts in the morning? I said, yeah. Oh, boy, that means you have to get up early, huh? I said, yeah. He said, how early? I said, I get up at 5 after 1. Well, why don't you get up at 1 o'clock? I said, because I like to sleep in.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today. The issue of concussions in professional sports has gotten a great deal of attention as high-profile athletes have been sidelined and as former athletes have sued leagues such as the NFL for failing to protect them. Though most of us have never played pro sports and neither will our children, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reports around 173,000 kids are treated each year for sports-related traumatic brain injuries. In high school, the greatest numbers are in football and girls' soccer, but they happen in nearly every sport. But amid this data, a Milwaukee researcher said there's actually some good news in our understanding of concussions and how we help people recover. Dr. Michael McCray is neuropsychology consultant for the Green Bay Packers. His work as director of brain injury research at the Medical College of Wisconsin has earned him one of the Head Health Initiative grants through GE Healthcare and the NFL. He's with us in the studio to share more on his work. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
How have the questions that we have asked about concussions changed in recent years? And maybe more importantly, why have they changed?
I would say for starters, if you go back 20 or 30 years, there really were no questions. There was very little attention paid to this topic or this injury at any competitive level. Then in the 90s, largely because several high-profile athletes came forward discussing their concerns about the potential effects of their repetitive concussion history, we started to really hone in on clinical investigations and better ways of managing concussion during the acute window. So, for instance, on the sports sideline or rink side, and then in the ensuing days following concussion as to how to best diagnose, evaluate, and manage an athlete affected by concussion, and then ultimately determining when it's safe for that athlete to return to play. If you look at the body of work over the last 10 or 15 years, there's been an incredible amount of science that has now given us best practice approach to managing the acute injury.
Is it oversimplifying things to say in the past we were taking a one-size-fits-all approach?
For the most part. And in the past, we managed concussion much like we did other injuries in that when an athlete told us that they had made a complete recovery, we gave them the green light. We now have more objective measures and ways of determining an athlete's level of recovery and readiness to return to play. Now, the new questions that are on the horizon really relate to the potential long-term effects of concussion, not confined to, for instance, the first several days after the injury.
You mentioned this idea of how we measure recovery. How do we now, today, how are we able to quantify whether a recovery has taken place and whether it's a complete recovery?
Sure. Well, we keep in mind that athletes obviously are highly motivated to return to competition as quickly as they can after any sort of injury, including concussion. So it's always been thought that it might be problematic to rely solely on an athlete's self-report of their symptom recovery and making clinical decisions based on it.
I'm ready. Put me back in the game.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And we laugh that oftentimes that proclamation from the athlete may come as early as within minutes of the injury. But certainly it would come, for instance, on the following Thursday when the football game is the following night. What we've developed over the past 2 decades is an array of clinical measures that give us a more objective assessment of recovery. And those really fall into, I guess, multiple categories, including neurocognitive testing, balance testing, and other performance-based measures of recovery. Now, in most paradigms, we administer that battery of measures prior to the season and obtain a what we refer to as a baseline assessment on each individual athlete against which we can compare their performance after an injury and track their recovery back to their normal baseline and make decisions on recovery based on that approach.
You mentioned the high-profile injuries in the 90s as one of the catalysts for this kind of research to really get going. You know, there are still these high-profile injuries in professional sports in which sometimes athletes have sustained concussions that have caused them to lose entire seasons of play or even knocked them out of sports entirely. How common is it for a concussion's effects to linger so long after the injury was sustained?
Uncommon. So if you look at the broad base of the literature in prospective studies over the past 20 years or more, you'll find that at all competitive levels, including youth and high school sports, somewhere in the neighborhood of 85 to 90% of athletes achieve a complete recovery based not only on what they're telling us in terms of their symptoms, but even on these performance-based measures of recovery in the order of roughly 7 to 10 days. Now, there's a large percentage of athletes that have a complete recovery in the order of 3 to 5 days, and about 10% of athletes have a recovery time that extends beyond 7 days. But across all studies, for instance, less than 2% of athletes have any elevation in their symptoms or lingering impairments that persist beyond, for example, 45 days. So as a sports parent, like I am, that's pretty good news.
Well, and at the same time, when something like this does happen, would you imagine that it's possible that one of these injuries that really does take a much longer time to achieve recovery, might it have come on the heels of an undiagnosed head injury that had happened in the weeks prior?
Yes, we often see that multiple concussions over a short period of time often result in a lengthier recovery period. I would say we see it in at least two forms. One is where a concussion may have occurred, for instance, as you said, last week, and a second concussion occurs yesterday. So two apparent injuries over the course of a week, and the athlete comes forward after the second injury. And oftentimes we see a lengthier recovery time in that scenario. The second scenario, however, is perhaps what some might consider more benign, but also extends recovery time, and that is an athlete sustains an injury and either continues to participate and sustain non-concussive routine head impacts over a short period of time, or returns to play too early after an injury and has a setback. And in those two scenarios as well, we often see a more extended recovery time.
Well, and so if we think of head injuries in terms of cumulative effects, if a person completely recovers from a concussion and then sustains another one, say 6 months or a year down the road, does that recovery that happened mean that these are now two unconnected issues, or are there still cumulative effects in the years down the road?
Not entirely clear yet. So one thing that we know for certain is that our phrase is concussion often begets concussion. And that is, we've published studies, for instance, showing that athletes who have three or more prior concussions coming into a football season, for example, are anywhere from 4 to 8 times more likely than their teammate who has no prior history of concussion of sustaining another concussion that season within a 3 to 4 month period. What we don't know from the science yet is whether or not it's something about the vulnerability of Johnny's brain that leads him to repetitive injury, or his threshold of injury being diminished with each incident, or is it something about the way Johnny plays football that puts him at greater risk of concussion? You know, one comment I will also make is that there is a very tight association between recovery time and risk. If you look at the studies, including our work, you will find that, for instance, somewhere between 75 and 90% of repeat concussions within a sports season occur within the first 7 to 10 days of the initial injury. So it turns out that that 7 to 10-day window is not only the period of typical recovery of brain structure and function, it's also the period of time during which the athlete is at greatest risk of repeat injury. And that's really what helps guide our management strategies to prevent them and protect them from risk during that earliest 7 to 10-day window.
7 to 10 days is significant in football, though, because it means missing a game.
That's right. In a high school football paradigm, for instance, an injury occurs on Friday night. The data show that that athlete is at elevated risk should he return too soon and participate inside that 7-day window. On the other hand, injury on Friday night, adequate rest and graded return to activity over a period of several days, and then resumes practice the following Monday, meaning 10 days later, the data show that that athlete is significantly out of the woods at that point.
You are involved with the NFL's Head Health Initiative, and the league has taken plenty of heat for how it approached head injuries in the past. How does this approach differ from the kinds of things that the NFL and potentially other sports leagues were looking at in years past?
Sure. Well, I think there's probably two lines of response there. You are correct. My colleagues and I at the Medical College of Wisconsin were fortunate recently to be awarded one of the first GE NFL Head Health Challenge grants. So the Head Health Challenge program is a collaborative effort between GE, the NFL, and now Under Armour that is a research-based program to advance the science of sport-related concussion and traumatic brain injury in civilians, military service members, and other populations at risk. Really, the aim of that program is to develop more objective biological markers and advanced clinical measures above and beyond what we have available to us today that would continue to improve upon the current state of diagnosis, prognosis, and return to activity decision making. At the same time, the NFL Head, Neck, and Spine Committee that I'm a member of has been charged with developing evidence-based protocols for diagnosis, assessment, management, and return to play, and those have been disseminated across the league in the past 5 years.
You mentioned the involvement of Under Armour, and I think the question a lot of people probably ask when they hear about head injuries is about equipment. Is there ever going to be anything that prevents a concussion from taking place in football or hockey or any other contact sport?
Good question. I don't know about ever, but the data thus far really have failed to demonstrate that any single piece of equipment, whether it be a helmet, a customized mouth guard, or other adaptive equipment, have had any impact in decreasing the incidence or severity of concussion. That said, all of those pieces of equipment are critically important to athlete health and safety. Mouth guards, for instance, have been incredible in preventing and reducing dental injuries. Helmets have reduced the incidence of skull fracture and more severe traumatic brain injury, which is our foremost consideration above and beyond concussion. That said, concussion itself is what we refer to as an acceleration-deceleration injury. So the ability for an external shell, a helmet for instance, to completely negate that is really not a possibility at this point. It's what happens inside the helmet, inside the skull, that produces this functional injury, thankfully without structural injury like we would see without helmet.
What about the idea of down the road having better treatments to stimulate recovery? That's something we don't often hear discussed. Is there ever going to be an effort to mitigate a concussion after it's happened?
Oh, no question. That has certainly been a shortage in the research to date on concussion over the last 20 or 30 years. We've spent most of our time and energy and funding studying the underlying mechanism of the injury, its pathophysiology, how we evaluate it, but there have not been a lot of studies focused on treatment interventions to accelerate recovery or provide neuroprotection against future injury. That certainly is going to be a major wave in the next generation of the science, studying the effects, for instance, of active rehabilitation, There's a line of research out there right now that really is addressing how long is long enough in terms of rest. And the prevailing school of thought right now, based on the evidence, is that a couple of days of rest is good for brain health after a concussion. But extended rest probably does more harm than good, and that it's really graded activity, or what we call active rehabilitation, that is most therapeutic after that initial short rest period.
I wonder if one of your missions in this work is to kind of rein in some of the emotion of this discussion. It gets a lot of ink, if you will.
Yes. And our observation in the past 3 years or so is that really the story has raced out in front of the science. And that is unfortunate in any health science area, including concussion. The reality is the risks to young athletes are relatively minor, particularly in the scenario of a single uncomplicated concussion. Now, when athletes sustain a concussion and either don't report it or they report it and they are prematurely returned to competition, the risk can be considerable. And it's our job to protect young athletes from those risks. But the science really has answered many of the critical questions, as I mentioned earlier, relevant to that early window. And just the same, the science will answer the questions about the potential long-term risks and hopefully ease some of the concern or even hysteria that has been raised in the public sector about this injury.
Well, Dr. Michael McRae, thank you so much for spending some time with us and shedding some more light on the issue of concussions.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Michael McRae is a professor of neurosurgery and neurology and director of brain injury research at the Medical College of Wisconsin. He's also a consultant to the Green Bay Packers and is doing research funded by a grant through the NFL and GE Healthcare's Head Health Initiative. NPR's Peter Sagal went cross-country on a Harley in search of the U.S. Constitution. The result was a public TV series and an event in Milwaukee later this month. We'll chat with Peter Sagal when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. NPR listeners know Peter Sagal's voice well. Since 1998, he's been the host of the weekly variety show and news quiz, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. But last year, Sagal's career took a somewhat more serious path as host of a four-part series on public television in which he told the story of the U.S. Constitution as it lives and breathes today. Sagal's trademark humor was on display as well, as was the Harley-Davidson motorcycle he used to get from place to place. Peter Sagal will talk about the experience next week at an event at the Harley-Davidson Museum in Milwaukee. He'll also undoubtedly touch on the news that his longtime colleague on Wait, Wait, Carl Castle, will soon retire. Peter Sagal joins us now from NPR in Chicago. Nice to speak with you.
My pleasure. I wish I could be there with you in person because you have excellent beer.
But not in the studio right now, unfortunately.
Really?
No.
That is Milwaukee. I thought to be a true Milwaukeean, you have to have some beer with you at all times.
You would think there would be a tap in the studio, wouldn't you?
You'd think. That's what I imagined. You've ruined my dreams.
Sorry. They're opening a Dunkin' Donuts on the first floor of our building, though, so that's something.
A pathetic excuse, please.
So I want to ask you about the Constitution USA project that premiered last year and that you're going to be talking about in a few short days in Milwaukee, but I don't want to bury the lead. Your partner in crime for hundreds of episodes of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me announced just recently that he will soon be retiring from his role as scorekeeper. What do you think it was that made Carl Castle such an ideal person for the job all those years?
Well, first of all, I should say that your phrase partners in crime is in our case literally true, because all these years we've been using Wait, Wait as a cover for our career as jewel thieves, which is why there have always been reports of unsolved smash and grab robberies in the towns where we bring Wait, Wait. What is it that has made Carl so special? Well, it's changed over the years, which I think is a credit to Carl, because when the show began, and we're talking about 1998 now, January is when it went on the air, Carl's main role in the show was just providing us some credibility. I mean, his status as the voice of, I don't know, fact on NPR and public radio in general just provided us this cloak that we could all hide under, like children under skirts. We were having this awkward adolescence on the air on just a few stations at that time. We weren't all that great, but because Carl was on the show, people were like, well, it must be good if Carl's on it. You know, he would never lend his talent and dignity to something that didn't have a promise. And then as we got better at doing the show, we found out that in addition to just being a great guy to have around, or, you know, like a great name to have on our letterhead, if you will, he actually is probably the world's greatest straight man. And I say this as a great fan of, you know, Bud Abbott, Bert from Sesame Street. I mean, the guy is such a great foil for everything we've done. And, you know, we've gotten increasingly silly over the years, but having Carl there as sort of this voice of reason to cock an eyebrow at us metaphorically and sometimes literally has just made our show better. And then, of course, one of the things I learned, you know, because I've been writing for the show and performing for the show for a long time, is that you can take any given punchline for any given bit, and it might be funny. If you can put it in Carl's mouth in a way that works for him, it's 10 times as funny. The man is a natural showman. So really, I mean, I could go on, for some time on this, but basically he has been the heart and soul of our shows from the beginning. And his departure will mean, you know, a significant change. And it's tough to contemplate.
And it's interesting the way you describe it, because it does strike me when you listened to the show early on, it seemed absurd that he was there on that show.
Yes, it absolutely was absurd. It was ridiculous.
And it no longer seems that way at this point. He's no longer an absurd part of the humor, except in so much as he's playing himself.
Yes, and that's exactly what I mean. He went from being this serious guy who lent credibility to this nascent, not very good comedy show to being, you know, like the comic heart and soul of this more successful comedy show. And again, that transition, the fact that, you know, that he had that in him. One of the jokes I've always, this is my favorite story about Carl, and I think it really sums all this up. And there are many stories about Carl, but this, as I say, remains my favorite. It was very early on, a couple months after I took over as the show's host, and they flew me out to Washington to take some publicity photos with me and Carl. And I really hardly knew the man at this time. We had worked together on the radio, but we'd only spent a few hours in each other's physical presence. And they brought us into a studio at NPR, and they were taking photographs of us. And it was a performance studio, and we were looking around for doing something more, you know, unusual than just standing there and smiling at the camera. So I pointed at the piano, and I said, "Have you ever seen the Fabulous Baker Brothers?" And the Fabulous Baker Boys, excuse me. And Carl said no. And I said, "Well, this is what we want you to do." And so I staged it. I was sitting in front of the piano pretending to play. Carl climbed on top of the grand piano like, you know, what's her name? Michelle Pfeiffer. Michelle Pfeiffer, thank you, and the Fabulous Baker Boys, and put his chin in his hand, right, and his elbow on the piano and sort of winked coquettishly at me as I played the piano. And this is Carl Castle, right? At the time, he's like, you know, a 65-year-old man doing this silly thing. And he looked at me and he said, "I've always wanted to do this." And that really is the secret, that all those years, you know, beneath the serious, stern voice of the newsman would beat the heart of a big old piece of Virginia ham. He really is a showman, and he always wanted to be a comedian, and has been one brilliantly.
So stipulating that that neither of the people in this conversation will ever be the Carl Castle of the future. Let's transition.
So stipulated.
Let's transition to your upcoming event in Milwaukee.
Yes,
you did this 4-part series on the U.S. Constitution that ran last year and is still available online. I imagine is seeing the light of day in reruns as well.
It is. You can also get it on DVD. And yes, it's called Constitution USA with Peter Sagal, and it's available these days on DVD. I think you can watch it on the PBS.org channel on your Apple TV or Roku or whatever. And I think some stations occasionally rebroadcast.
So the idea here is you sort of went out in search of the Constitution in action, and you rode a Harley to do this. And
yes.
So let me ask the obvious Milwaukee-centric question.
Please.
What did the Harley have to do with the trip?
Well, it sort of started like this. The documentary, well, of course, it had everything to do with the trip. In fact, I'd say you'd buried the lead when you did not mention the Harley first. speaking to a Milwaukee audience. The idea started with some producers based in New York, Insignia Films, which produced it on behalf of Twin Cities Public TV. And the notion was a road trip, right? We're going to take a road trip around America, and we're going to see how the Constitution is lived today. Because most people think of the Constitution as a historical document. You know, it was laid down either, you know, by divine insight or through the wisdom of giants of men, and, you know, 200 whatever years ago, and thus it remains, and, you know, we should approach it with veneration in the way that you would say a religious text. And in fact, the Constitution is alive and well, and people out there in America are living it for good or for bad. We've talked to some people who, you know, had gotten the short end of the constitutional stick. But these arguments and these debates are going on. So let's go out and find out, right? Okay, so we're going to go around America. We're going to talk to people about the Constitution. How do we get to them? And one of the producers, a gentleman named Chris Buchanan, was actually reading through one of my online bios, and it said, oh, Peter Segal wrote for a motorcycle magazine. Peter rides motorcycles. Peter should ride around the country on a motorcycle. Now, once you've made that decision, that you're going to ride around the country in a motorcycle looking for the Constitution, for the spirit of America, what are you going to ride? A Kawasaki? You're going to get one of those little Honda scooters? No, you're going to get some big old Milwaukee Iron, in this case, a 2012 Road King, pretty much stock, but with a great paint job. And that's what we did. I rode that thing around the country from California to Virginia and back and forth, and had a pretty awesome time.
Did it represent an opportunity to do something meatier maybe for you? I mean, wait, don't tell me. Obviously, is a smart show,
yes.
But this is a different animal.
Yeah, people ask me that a lot. And I would say that, you know, well, why are you doing this strange thing about the Constitution? Why not, you know, do more jokes about people sticking animals down their pants? And I would say that, you know, everything I do on Wait, Don't Tell Me, most especially the stuff about politics, is actually about the Constitution. You know, you make a joke about the president, that's a constitutional office. You make a joke about the Supreme Court, same. You make a joke about state legislatures, the fact that we have a state legislature and a national legislature. That's federalism. That's the Constitution. So I'm very interested in all of this stuff, even if it isn't necessarily funny. And yeah, you know, Wait is wonderful. I love it. It's the best job I could ever hope for. I get to have a lot of fun every week, but I'm also limited in what I can talk about because it has to be funny. It's a comedy show. We know that. That's why people tune in. They get lots of serious analysis everywhere else on public radio. So having a chance to talk about issues seriously was really an appeal. At the same time, civics, I mean, even saying that word probably made your eyes just, you know, roll back in the back of your head. Civics is like the most boring thing to most people because it's presented in the most boring way. You know, if you look at an eighth grade textbook, as my daughter had while I was doing this thing, you read about the Constitution. You see pictures of guys in Philadelphia wearing wigs and tights, and then you see boxes, you know, executive branch, judicial branch, and there are arrows, and then there's a chart showing the process of a bill, and then we're all asleep because it's incredibly dull. So my job and the producer's job was to get on that motorcycle, ride out, and make it interesting, or more to the point, show you, the viewer, how interesting, fascinating, important that it really is, to try to dust off this mustiness of civics as it's taught and understood and show you that the Constitution is actually underlying everything that we're arguing about, talking about, and to a great extent enjoying in America.
There's a reason why those of us a certain age remember the Schoolhouse Rock version of Why
yes,
Bill
I'm
Becomes
only
a Law.
Yes, I'm a bill. Yes, I'm only sitting here on Capitol Hill. Yes. Yes, we all remember that. And what's amazing is if you ask most people about the Constitution, they say, oh, I love the Constitution. And you say, what's in it? And they go, well, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which isn't in the Constitution. It's in the Declaration of Independence. But the one exception is every now and then you run into somebody who can sing the preamble because of Schoolhouse Rock. We the people. I can't sing. In order to form a more perfect union. That one.
The people you interview on Wait, kind of know what they're getting into. I mean,
oh, yes.
Was it ever uncomfortable for you going into the interviews for Constitution USA, going to talk to people who might have been suspicious of your motives or suspicious of PBS?
Well, that is a good question. There were a number of things going on. There was a suspicion of me from some quarters because I work for NPR and was doing a project for PBS, and because I'm a comedian. On the other hand, there was, I think, a bunch of advantages. The first advantage is that the people who know me from Wait, Don't Tell Me tend to like me because, you know, I'm making jokes on the radio. I'm not, you know, I'm not a polarizing figure. At least I hope I'm not. And they tend to feel, you know, fairly fond of me based on my professional thing. So we usually had an in. Second, and this is not a small thing, I rode up on this really cool motorcycle.
I was going to ask that question. I wonder if that opened doors.
It really did, because if you show up, I mean, you know, if you do the thing where you show up in a limousine and you step out and you adjust your tie, you know, and you adjust your earpiece like a, you know, Mike Wallace type correspondent, people are going to go, uh-oh. You know, they'll react to you like you're an agent from the Matrix. But if you show up wearing jeans and a leather jacket, full face, you know, and all the safety equipment, I didn't wear a full-face helmet, which, of course, I apologize to all the riders who are listening. I always wear full-face helmets when riding on my own, but with a full-face helmet, you cannot see someone's face on a TV camera, so they made me wear a half helmet, which I do not recommend. Anyway, if you show up on a brightly painted Harley-Davidson with We the People painted on the gas tank, people smile. You know, it's a more fun and accessible and open person that you're presenting when you do that. So that helped a lot. But the last and most important thing was, no matter who we were talking to, I approached them with a very sincere desire to hear their perspective. So we talked to people who, as you imply, might not trust PBS or NPR. We talked to a gun rights activist. We talked to property rights activists. We talked to a very involved intellectual activist, Robert P. George at Princeton University, who's very much opposed to gay marriage. And, you know, when we just gave these guys a chance, or women, as the case may be, and we said, you know, tell us your perspective, tell us your opinion. Why do you think this is true? And one of the most gratifying reviews or series of reviews that we got on this series was we got a really nice series of reviews from, say, the Heritage Foundation and other conservative websites and blogs and sources. And they basically had all the same thing to say. They said, oh, what do you know? This is fair. Wow, I didn't expect that. But it absolutely presents all points of view and presents the argument and our side of the argument, as the case may be, in a fair way. And we're very grateful. And that made me happy. I mean, it made me happy because that's what we wanted to do. We wanted to step back from the daily debates, you know, the constant warfare over the hot button issues, and pull back and say, you know, these are the arguments that are going on. This is why we have these arguments. In fact, these arguments are a sign of the Constitution's success, which was one of our major points.
There is no gotcha moment you have.
No, the last thing in the world I wanted to do was to make anybody feel like they had been taken advantage by us, that they had been misrepresented by us. That really would have, you know, just contradicted everything we all set out to do the day I got in the motorcycle.
What do you take from having done this series? You know, it ran last year. I imagine it was in production for some time before that.
Yes,
as you think
was.
Back on it.
It was a good 2 years of my life. Yeah.
Yeah. As you think back on it and look at where we are now in this kind of contentious time, what do you take from that experience?
You know, it's mixed. On the one hand, I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding about what the Constitution is, right? And I referred earlier to this notion that it was handed down to us in its original and unchanging form by divinely inspired men 225 years ago and hasn't changed and should not change ever since. That is, I think, whether or not it should be right, it is profoundly historically wrong. I mean, in the sense that the Constitution has changed both by amendment and by understanding. You know, what I say is whether or not you think that the Constitution should be interpreted, it should not be considered a changing document. It has changed. That's a historical fact, right? Deal with it. And I think not enough people understand that. So there's a lot of, well, that's unconstitutional. There's nothing about that in the Constitution. The extreme version of that argument is the Air Force argument, i.e. the Constitution says that the Congress can have an army and a navy. It doesn't say anything about an Air Force, so therefore the Air Force is unconstitutional. And most people think that's ridiculous. I mean, obviously, they didn't know about airplanes in 1787, so we just understand that's part of the armed forces and deal with it. But there are some people who believe in that argument, and that kind of thinking, I think, is far too prevalent. That's the bad part. The good part is this, and I think that the good part wins. All of the arguments we're having, all of the vicious denunciations of the other side, and I mean that in a bipartisan or eight, you know, octopartisan way, however many different points of view you think there are active in our debates, all of the denunciation and the arguments and the threats and the insults, all of that shows that the Constitution is in fact working. Because the Constitution, despite what a lot of people think and the way that a lot of people cite it, was not meant to settle arguments. It was meant to allow us to have arguments without killing each other. And with one pretty major exception, the Civil War, we have managed for 225 years to have these very bitter arguments without actually tearing each other apart, you know? What I say to people is, if you don't like this constitutional democracy that we have because you think it's too, bitter or too dysfunctional, whatever, if you really want to know what the alternative is like, look at Game of Thrones, because that's what human history was until we had this amazing invention of the U.S. Constitution, where if you had a beef with your neighbor, you got your friends together, got some weapons, went over there and killed him. That was how we settled our differences for the most part. And now we settle our differences by screaming at each other on cable TV, which can be ugly, but it's a lot better. So I ended with a sense of optimism that that is still working, that we all still manage to get along, even if we're not actually getting along.
What is that line? Democracy is the worst political system except for everything else?
Exactly. Usually credited to Winston Churchill, but he's credited with a lot of things he didn't actually say. Yeah, I mean, basically, that's basically it. You know, that nobody promised us a rose garden, even though we have one in the White House. And, you know, there's a line we use. It's like, you know, nobody ever promised it would be perfect. It was supposed to be more perfect. And right there in the preamble, a more perfect union, is the notice that, you know, we will never solve all our problems. But the Constitution gives us a way to try to solve them, and often successfully solve them, peacefully.
Well, Peter Sagal, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. A real pleasure to talk to you guys, and I look forward to coming up to the Harley-Davidson Museum in Milwaukee.
Peter Sagal is the host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He's also the host of the public television series Constitution USA, which aired last year. Sagal will talk about the experience in an event called Untold Stories with Peter Sagal, 2,000 miles in 225 years, finding the U.S. Constitution on a motorcycle at the Harley-Davidson Museum on Saturday, March 22nd. There is a link to more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. As we heard, Carl Castle is soon retiring from his role on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. We'll listen back to our 2012 interview with him when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. Before the break, we spoke with NPR's Peter Sagal, who will be in Milwaukee later this month to talk about his cross-country trip in search of the U.S. Constitution astride a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. Sagal also weighed in on the announcement that his longtime co-star on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me will soon be retiring. Carl Castle was already a longtime morning newscaster on NPR when he signed on as the official scorekeeper for the Variety Quiz Show in 1998. He retired from newscasting around 3 years ago, but stayed on as Sagal's straight man. Carl Castle joined us when Wait, Wait made a Milwaukee stop in 2012. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed my trip here to Milwaukee.
Let me have you flash way back, if you would. What was your first job in radio?
My first job was back in 1950. I've been in the business 62 years. I was in high school. We had a great high school drama department, and one course they taught was radio, something I'd wanted to do even before I began going to school in the first grade. I used to play with my grandmother's old wind-up Victrola. She had one or two records, and I'd play a record, make up a commercial, play a record, and make up a newscast and do that right there in the home, and had fun doing it. Anyhow, in high school, they had one course in the drama department on radio. We were learning how to create pictures in people's minds with the use of music, sound effects, and voice. So I did a lot of theater on stage as well as high school plays, radio plays. And we were given 15 minutes a week on the local radio station to do high school news. I got to read that news a few times, and that summer the manager offered me a part-time job, paid me $1 an hour. I would have paid him if I had the money, but it was so much fun, and that's how I started.
I'm curious because, actually, I can also trace my interest in radio to about first grade and doing a lot of the same things. Do you remember when you were that young what it was that captured your imagination about radio?
That noise and those sounds and those voices out of the box, I loved it. And that's why sometimes I'd hide behind our radio console, those big old things back in the old days, and when people would come by, walk by, I would pretend I was on the radio. And that voice you hear is me, not somebody else. But they knew who was back there. But I wanted to do it from the get-go.
Did you find that by the time the radio station hired you part-time, you had essentially taught yourself the business?
No, not really. Back in those days, I did not want to do news. See, back then, radio station, you worked a shift and you did what was on the shift. You played records, you read a newscast that you ripped off the wire, you did commercials, and you swept the floor, things like that. You did a little bit of everything. So it was a well-rounded vacation in broadcasting, and I wanted to be an entertainer because that's what I did on the stage.
Well, so then what changed that you did not spend all those 60-plus years in radio hosting the morning zoo, if you will?
I did it for a long time, and I began in the business in 1950. And after 2 years in the Army after college, I went to a station in Alexandria, Virginia, and that was 1965, and played records in the morning. It was a country music station. Hey, that was fun. And I had a friend who worked at an all-news station in Arlington, Virginia, and he called me up one morning and said that we need a weekend anchor. If you're interested, you need the money, the job is yours. Well, I was interested, and I needed the money, so I took the job. I worked at two stations at the same time. And that went on for a while until eventually when they could make up the difference at the all-news operation, then I went there full-time. I put the records behind me, and I began reading books and talking to people about doing news and how it's done and so forth. And it was fun. There was a lot of good things happening there in that time. I don't want to say good things, but a lot of stories were breaking in that time. We had the Vietnam War and the demonstrations downtown Washington, Man on the Moon, assassinations of Martin Luther King, Bobby Kennedy, and so forth. So a lot of big things were happening. It was a time where you really had to learn something new. So I did that for a while, and in 1977, the same friend called me up again. He was working with a new organization called National Public Radio. I'm producing a program called All Things Considered on the Weekend. I need a weekend newscaster. Are you interested? I went over there for a while, but I couldn't keep it for long because being a news director at the other station, your time is filled there. So I dropped out. And about a few months later, the owner of the all-news station decided to sell the station, and I went back to NPR hat in hand. You got a job over here for me. And there was a newscast opening in the morning, so I took that, and I'm still there.
You have had a couple of years since you left that newscaster role at NPR. What are the experiences at NPR, or even before that, over the course of your radio career that still rise to the top?
Well, some stories come up that you're not expecting. A lot of things happen in the morning hours and not in the afternoon for some reason. Well, they're overseas, but except for 9/11, which happened in the morning here. So I'd say that was one of the big stories we carried and did because so things were happening so fast. To sit down and write a newscast for that, you couldn't do it because you'd be outdated by the time you got to the newsroom or the studio. So you find yourself printing copy, wire copy, and underlining what you want to talk about and looking for some audio. Well, we have a producer who's doing the same thing, looking for audio to put in and answering basic questions about who did this, why are they doing it, are there going to be more attacks, and so forth. So that was the big one. Then you had the Oklahoma City bombing. You had the assassination attempt on the Pope. You have to be ready for anything that happens. And, of course, during an election year, you've got to be fair to both sides. And we get memos all the time about be careful what you're reporting. Be sure you've got both sides on that newscast.
In all those years, you know, it was you in the booth. Did you ever miss having the chance to be the one that was out there on the scene of these news events that were happening as they happened?
Believe it or not, never. I was happy being in the studio rather than going out and reporting. I was not trained as a reporter. I don't know if I could do it, even now. Maybe I could. I don't know. But I preferred being in the studio and reporting on what was going on.
You, as we said, retired from your full-time work at NPR just over 2 years ago. Why did you want to stay on with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me?
Well, actually, I'm still working full-time. They gave me another job as NPR's roving ambassador. But several years ago, the program's in its 15th year, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And about 2 years before then, I was at a conference in Boston program directors. And I was asked one night to introduce all the NPR personalities who were also there. And I did, and went down the line one by one and cracked a joke here and there. And at the end, I said, well, that's it, folks. And another guy in the back yelled, but you didn't tell us about yourself. Well, what do you want to know? I said, you do newscasts in the morning? I said, yeah. Oh, boy, that means you have to get up early, huh? I said, yep. He said, how early? I said, I get up at 5 after 1. Well, why don't you get up at 1 o'clock? I said, because I like to sleep in. And that joke was heard by Doug Berman. He was there. He thought it was funny. And the next day they came to me and asked if I'd like to be on this new quiz program. I said, well, as long as I keep my newscast job. That was fine.
You wanted to stick with it even after leaving the newscast. Does this go back to your, do you feel like to some degree it goes back to your roots as an entertainer?
Very much so. Oh, I'd never give up. Wait.
At the same time, there are relatively few. You had been in radio for, I guess, not quite 50 years when you started with Wait. There are relatively few people who had been in radio for that long who suddenly see themselves in a position where there is a bobblehead doll that looks like them.
Well, there's the bobblehead doll. There's also the castle pillow, if you've seen that, and also the little Tweety doll, which I understand that little young kids love. Young girls especially love that doll. The pillow, I might add, when I took one home, I walked in, I just put it in the chair in the living room, and our dog walked in, a lab, dear Sophie. She looked at it and went, growled at it. She's become used to it by now.
You talked about how you got into radio. People that are just entering the business today find their way into radio. I imagine there are some who still have had this romantic dream of radio since they were little, but radio's a different animal than it was 62 years ago. What is your take on the state of what people can listen to today when they turn on their computer versus the large, you know, imposing box that was in the living room when you started?
Technology has come so far, so fast over these years, it's kind of hard to believe that when I first got in the business and you heard a report from overseas, it was sent by shortwave, snap, crackle, pop, you know, in the background. Today, they email the report in on their computers, and we use it that way. NPR at one time, well, it happened several years ago, but in the old days, stations sent their, the networks sent the programs to the stations by way of telephone wire. NPR became the first to do it by satellite. Everybody does it by satellite now. It's amazing the technology that has come along. Back when I joined NPR, we edited programs which were always on tape. More fingers were cut with those razor blades cutting that tape and putting two pieces together.
I'll show you my scars.
I can imagine putting those pieces together. Now it's done with a computer. So we've come a long way, and I expect as years go by, we'll look back at today and say, boy, that was kind of old-time stuff back then, wasn't it?
What do you like about this business still the most today?
Well, as a friend of mine used to say, it sure beats working for a living. He taught me a lot about radio, and I kind of feel that way. I've never felt that I really worked a day in my life in the business. A few years ago, I was at a function in Boston where the car guys were having some anniversary, and they had the Smothers Brothers, Dr. Joyce Brothers, the Brothers in Blue were there, and of course the guys who are brothers themselves. And I was talking to Dickie Smothers for a while, and I said, well, by the way, I haven't seen you guys on TV or heard about you for a long time. I thought you'd retired. Dickie said, retired from what? People retire from work because it's work. What I do, I don't consider work. There's nothing to retire from, and I feel the same way about my job. There's nothing to retire from. It is not work as far as I'm concerned. It's fun.
What were those first days? There had not been a variety show quite like this on public radio in the past. What was the inception of Wait, Don't Tell Me like?
It was a case of people, the stations wanted something on the weekend, had some humor to it, more than just straight news for all things considered, weekend programs like that. So the idea of maybe a comedy a quiz program might do it. Take a look, a funny look at an oddball look at the week's news. So we started, and we had a panelist, three of them, as we have today. And it wasn't that good. I have a copy of the first program we did. It was awful. I'm serious. We didn't know where we were going, how to be funny about the news or whatever. And stations told us as time went along, we'll never carry that piece of junk at all. And some of them didn't. They've come around since then. And we had another host that didn't work out. And this panelist we had who came to us, he was a writer. He'd written plays, he'd written magazine, newspaper articles, and loved his writing. And they told us he was fast with a joke and could come up with one real easily. So we brought in Peter Sakel, and after they decided to make a change, he looked pretty good. So they asked Peter if he would take it. He didn't want it. He wanted to write. I'm a writer. I'm not a radio guy. And I don't know a thing about radio. Well, a little persuasion, and he did take it. And after that, we began to play with different ideas on the show, what to do. And then, as Peter says, all of a sudden, it just came to us, the name of Monica Lewinsky. And after that, we knew that as long as we had politicians and dumb criminals, we'd be okay. They said, like manna from heaven, all those Viagra came out about the same time. So here we go. And we found out that formula works. Just follow politicians anywhere in the world. And that's how we are, a unit that we have fun with and have fun with the audience.
Well, thanks again.
My pleasure.
Carl Castle recorded 2 years ago in a Milwaukee hotel room. Castle announced recently that he'll soon retire as official scorekeeper on the NPR quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. He stepped down as morning newscaster on the network in 2010. That's all for the Wednesday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich. So great to have you listening today, as it always is. I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.